The question that I want to pose for us is, how shall we observe Memorial Day 1980, Iran, Afghanistan, Holden? I didn't know at the time of posing the question that the Vespers would be one answer to that question. The reason I pose that as a question is because it's a sincere question for me. The 1980 has gotten off to a rather auspicious beginning. We're somewhere in the 200s of the days that the hostages have been held in Iran, and one failed rescue mission later, shortly before I left Washington, D.C. President Carter was the eulogist for a memorial service for the 8 killed American servicemen. The USSR has been in Afghanistan with continued resistance, and there has been an escalation of the conflict between East and West. It isn't a revival of the Cold War of the 50s, but it is certainly an escalation of East-West confrontation and conflict. There is now in Congress an effort to balance the budget, but tilted in the direction of an increase in defense spending and with commitments to an increase of $1 trillion over the next 5 years. It's not quite yet reached that point in Congress that it has in the dining hall at Holden Village, where it says, quote, "It would be great if schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to have a bake sale to buy a bomber." The message has not gotten through to Washington. SALT II has been deterred, and detente has been sidetracked, although there may have been the beginnings of a renewal of discussion on detente in the meeting between the new Secretary of State Muskie and Prime Minister Gromyko. There has been a movement at the President's behest to begin registration, this time of men and women, with many men and women, and not a small number in Congress, resisting that. It is an election year. I think it's clear to say that there is deep voter dissatisfaction. I read a letter to the editor of the Washington Post the other day that was a three-liner, and it said, "The country needs John Anderson, the country wants Ronald Reagan, and the country will probably get Jimmy Carter." But we observe Memorial Day this year. There is a flag flying from one of the chalets. I think to capture the national mood may go something like this. There is, I think, with the situation in Iran, a kind of reflection upon our place in the international company of nations, in which we sense a changed place for the United States in the world, but we have a very uncertain response to a sense of a changed place. And I thought it might be appropriate to read a paragraph from Reinhold Niebuhr's The Irony of American History.
What?
The Irony of American History. An element of irony lies in the fact that a strong America is less completely master of its own destiny than was a comparatively weak America, rocking in the cradle of its continental security and serene in its infant innocence. The same strength which has extended our power beyond the continent has also interwoven our destiny with the destiny of many peoples and brought us into a vast web of history in which other wills, running in oblique or contrasting directions to our own, inevitably hinder or contradict what we most fervently desire. We simply cannot have our way. Yet not even when we believe our way to have the happiness of mankind as its promise. I at least have had a sense of that irony that a comparatively strong America is less a master of its own wishes than was a weak America at an earlier period. Well, it is Memorial Day. It is a day, as was mentioned at the beginning of the Vespers, a day of remembrance of those who have fallen in past wars. It is also a day, I think, of national stock-taking, and a day to really look to the future lured by a vision of peace. And I thought it important that we not let the day pass without talking about it. So I pose the question, how shall we observe Memorial Day 1980? What are your thoughts? What would be an appropriate way to keep faith with a tradition that has remembered the soldiers in the hope that there be no more war? What kind of responses do you have?
The same way we think, by praying for them and everything else, you know, thanking them, being happy that they did try, you know.
By observing it as we did.
That an opportunity is available to us right now to engage in that battle, taking the, you know, pinpointing the proper enemy. And from that perspective and through that kind of activity, the day finally and ultimately will come when there's going to be peace. My way of thinking, there's two kingdoms on earth. There's the kingdom of darkness and there's the kingdom of light. And it's not a cold war, it's a hot war. It's been going on since the beginning and it's going on today. And what we see in the world today are manifestations politically and economically and nationally of really that basic fact. So, you know, for a lot of poor, dumb, blind, deluded people in every generation have all been taken by death because they were confused and thinking that their enemy was other people.
So what is the enemy?
Death, the kingdom of darkness, which would like to take us all.
Do you think if everybody knew God, though, do you think that we would never have wars?
Right.
I don't agree
with
that.
I don't believe
in that. In the scriptures of the Old Testament, there's many learned people here in this room, and the scriptures all point many times to when God, all he wanted was for the Israelites, for example, or us, to turn to him, and he'll fight the battle for us. And he's done it many, many times.
But is that a violent battle? Is it a battle of guns and bombs?
Why, sure, they were about battle, but in the Old Testament, it's very clear.
Now, may I amend my remarks to say that what it says is Jesus came to destroy the works of the devil.
No.
And when the works of the devil are destroyed in Europe, then the conflicts that we now have won't exist in the same form of conflict.
I don't understand. I need to kind of create what is the work of the devil.
Well, I guess to speak broadly, depending on whether you take a material view of the realm we live in, or whether you recognize that there are spiritual forces at work as well. And I presume that speaking to a Christian group, that we understand that there's a spiritual realm. And there are, well, for example, like take a place like India, for example, where the Hindus and the Muslims
the drop of a hat, slaughter each other by the thousands, you know. And they have just all kinds of problems. Well, at the same time, you know, the Hindus have millions of gods, and you've seen the pictures of their deities, you know, and these are idols that are the same kind of thing that God questions and then rebukes his people about all through the Bible. And what they're doing is worshiping demons, is what they're worshiping. Perhaps you had exposure to transcendental meditation understood. Everyone's given a mantra, you know, and this is told to them that this is just a nonsense word. It means nothing at all. But it's clear, particularly, you know, Paul talks about it a lot. He says in Galatians, you know, you once were in bondage to elemental spirits of the universe, and don't turn back to me. You've been freed by Christ from bondage to elemental spirits of the universe. And this mantra, for example, is the name of one of the elemental spirits.
Okay, I would say that the military industrial complex is a demonic spiritual force.
You bet.
You know, and I need to see it, you know, not in terms of kind of spiritual demons floating around, but in...
Okay.
And that's not the Hindus slaughtering each other, that's Christians who belong to the Chamber of Commerce slaughtering each other.
Well, there's a great history of the independence of India, the Muslims and the Hindus, and they finally got to...
They probably slaughter each other too, but I guess what I'm saying is I don't think that it's a situation where you can say they do and we don't.
That was just a clear example, because they clearly worship demons there, and we do more subtly here, but it's true that we do.
I think we do it just as clearly. We just like to cover our eyes and not see it.
Well, it could well be. It's true that we do, you bet. Yeah. And that's the problem. And I guess I thought I said that you know, this battle of the two kingdoms is manifested in politics and economics and military issues.
Maybe to go back to Larry's question, maybe I shouldn't do this, but I think you need to ask how to observe. Maybe to give us another chance to departure. It occurred to me that it might be helpful. I think back to Memorial Day observances when I was in the high school band. We always marched to the cemetery and stood around in our uniforms, and somebody gave a speech, and we played taps in the cemetery, and flags were raised and lowered and folded and all kinds of things, and then we all marched back home. And I lived on a small lake in Iowa, which is rarely, so we threw a wreath into the lake too, just to symbolize the fact that there's all the little sea battles that I know of that we fought there. But the overwhelming feeling I had was that the people who were really gung-ho on celebrating or commemorating Memorial Day had a vision of the people who had been killed in war as having been heroes. And I would just abridge that a little bit. Maybe a helpful thing to do would be to see them as martyrs. And the difference being that a hero is somebody who's kind of macho, maybe this isn't true, but I'm thinking like a John Wayne type figure, plunges into battle, grits his teeth, and is killed. Whereas a martyr is someone who's sacrificed, probably unwillingly, and it's a tragedy for the person's death. And I think we have to start seeing the results of war as tragedy rather than as some glorious thing. And that might be a helpful change in attitude.
It is a sobering thought that in most nations, the heroes have been the leaders in battle. That is, those who have commanded the forces that have killed others have been regarded as heroes. I mean, if you look at the statuary in most nations, the statuary of military figures, but it's not a sense of martyr, or it's not a sense of tragedy so much as it is a sense of conquering or at best defending. But it has been, in any case, a destruction of human life.
It said that ancients built their war memorials in wood so that they would decay quickly and be forgotten.
So,
in Washington, D.C., where we live, we were surrounded by marble statues.
Yeah.
Generals riding to the
yeah.
Enemy.
If there were two people shooting at each other, really violent, using weapons and stuff like this, and you say one was your best friend, you know, and you really care a lot, would you just sit there and pray for him or run out and say, you know, God save you both, or would you go out and help them out, you know? Which would you do?
Help them out?
Right, well, I mean, you know, would you fight physically, or are you going to mentally pray to God, thinking everything is, you know, they will stop? Because, like, you know, we're called to go out and fight and stuff like this, you know, and all this, you know, most of us don't, like, you know, it's controversial, but, I don't know, I just seem to get all this feeling that everybody's just going to stand back, and you've got, like, that song, God, the Source of Power, that he will just, you know, stop it all if we just all pray to him. Well, it's really not that way. It's different, more different. Mm-hmm. And like people aren't being very realistic about it when they, you know, when they say, you know, well, I'm just gonna run from it and everything, you know. So you don't want to kill, but you know, you can't just sit there and you can pray to God, but you can't depend on the bully. That, you know, if someone's in there, he's gonna shoot you. You know, you can pray to God. If, try to help you out and everything, maybe to change this guy's mind, but if you shoot, you know, send him a shot. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I can't see him. Okay. And how does everybody else feel about that?
I mean, maybe, put it another way, do we regret having participated in World War II?
Let's put it another way again. If you were to go to Germany today and meet someone your age, would you shoot that person or would you sit down and have a conversation?
It just all depends on
what's the difference?
You and that person.
I mean, what was the difference 20 years ago? Because that person was drafted too.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, there were horrible things done in Germany, but there were horrible things done in Vietnam. I mean, it gets really unclear, I think.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. That's why, really, in the last analysis, other people are not our enemy. We have another enemy, and it's everybody's enemy.
And then you have, okay, if that's true, then why do we keep fighting wars? I mean, this is what really throws me, is when I sit down and think, well, in January, listening to Jim Carter on the television, saying, basically saying blatantly, we will go to war to protect oil.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of trouble with that.
Well, you know, we're living in a demented world. The world is demented.
But that's what, the kind of reason that's always caused war.
Yeah, well, it says war is, you know, war is caused by greed. If you don't have what you want, so you fight and you kill.
But because the world is demented doesn't mean we have to be demented.
That's right, and that's the one hope and the
but
one
we don't
hope
rest
that there
on
is.
It,
it's the one hope that there is, that light can be brought into the human heart on a global scale.
Where do you find the light?
Christ.
I know how many people believe in Christ and don't shoot back.
Very few.
I know. So what do you do?
Well, you said shoot back, you know.
That's what they should do.
Alternative of when violence is about to be done, she set up only two choices, that one, you pray and stand by and like, mentally pray or something, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that the other alternative would be to go in there and actively shoot and try and defend your friend.
Well, you can do both too. You can also pray and, you know, you know, like you can still have it be in touch with God, but it's not going to have a shield out in front of you. Don't believe that. You know?
Well, yeah, I agree, and it seems like there's a third alternative, and it seems like it's the cross, pure and simple, and that is that in the face of violence, you don't just have two options, to shoot back or to retreat and just pray. You can actively not let the fear of death rule you, and you can actively resist the physical violence
knowing that it may very well cost your life. And it seems like given the situations of Iran and Afghanistan and much that's going on in the world, that as Christian people, a lot of young people in this country who are facing the draft, you're presented with some options there. And maybe there's an option of actively resisting that option of violence and being willing to go to prison for it, not pay your war taxes. Maybe people will even become violent against conscientious objectors, I don't know. But it seems like we're always throwing out, the only alternative is to retreat and be passive and to hold your hand and pray, or shoot back. And I think that the cross is a radically different third option that very well and realistically can call for your life.
True, but I get this comeback from, like tonight, from just kind of feeling it in the air that, like, a bunch of religious people going out in the middle of the field, where they're fighting and just going out there huddling up and praying and just all get shot up.
That's not what she's saying, though.
Mm-hmm. See, I know that's not what you're saying, but that's the kind of feeling I get from tonight when, oh, God,
So, Marilyn, I guess I understand that as a call for particular stance on the part of the Christian community, and that people who take that kind of stance do so out of a choice that is made with their whole being. But then the question for me is, if I'm also a citizen of a nation, is there some national policy that I should press for that would be a proper way of observing Memorial Day? And when you press for some national policy, then you do something other than something, call for something that can only be made as a personal choice. The character of national policy is that it has the force of law, and whether people want to accede to it or not, they are bound by it. The character of the pacifist witness is that it is his or her own choice, but that choice cannot be made except voluntarily. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to turn one's own cheeks. It's another thing to turn the cheeks of others. So I asked myself, out of your question, what it would mean to observe Memorial Day, or what kind of national policy would you press for, as even out of the vocation of Christian pacifism?
Well, in the concrete situation right now, SALT II is still widely being considered.
Mm-hmm.
The Hatfield Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
To stop, not to any fancy programs of de-escalation, don't build this kind of missile, you can build only this kind, but to simply stop. But,
mm-hmm.
And it always ends up sounding very naive.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I feel like we're citizens of the kingdom of God voluntarily and of choice. We're not forced into that citizenship. And that as long as I can be a citizen and work of the United States and work within that system where it does not compromise my ultimate loyalty to the kingdom of God, I can work within that system. At any point where that breaks down, as a Christian, I cannot do what my nation sees as necessary or right.
Okay. Other thoughts on what you would see as the kind of direction that national policy should move? I suppose especially with respect to arms and armaments, since we're focusing on Memorial Day, or positively speaking, what directions would peace look like?
Well,
what kinds of policies would you press for out of a sense of Christian vocation, but living as also a citizen of a particular nation?
Building no more arms.
And use the money for positive things like education, housing and feeding hungry folks. It's a big chunk of money and energy for all going off into destructive purposes that could be channeled elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. We demand a whole major radical change in our whole government system because there would have to be a government that is truly responsive to the people, I think, rather than being controlled by large corporations and money-making issues.
I don't think that's true. I think that, I think that polls show that they are being responsive.
Yes.
You know, I mean, the majority of Americans want more defense spending.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful about saying,
I don't think our government is necessarily responsive to people in the first place, and I think that a lot of times people think that the polls support that because of the way the government is. It's the government, which is anyway. That's complicated, forget it.
Well, I think it's true, though, on the other hand, that I think it is true that what the people think is very much controlled or very much affected by what they keep getting told them by the government. How the Russians... Never mind. How the Russians have this and they're slowly creeping. I mean, I'll admit, the public is often saying,
maybe we can continue this from the hospital, Peter. We can just go on talking and coughing and we'll be treated at the same time.
Okay, I think public opinion is very malleable.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
It seems like what the thing that I hear people say concerning defense spending is, I'm just saying, I hear people say, I don't know what people, I'm not going to elaborate, but it's been said to me, okay,
that people say.
My people I know, that the only way to preserve peace is to have a strong defense.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that, you know, that I have real struggles with maybe the difference is what is a strong defense and what is a strong offense. You know, maybe being able to destroy all the major cities in the world 11 times is a little beyond a strong defense. I don't know.
It is,
to what extent does a defense preserve peace, and to what extent are we deluding ourselves? And that's something I struggle with, because people say that to me, and I think, well, I don't know, maybe. And the other thing that I'm struggling with is that I don't know if it's possible for a government to have a policy that, and maybe we'd like our government to be able to base their actions on Christian principles, but I don't know if it's possible. I think there's a constant conflict between what we read in the scripture we must do as Christians,
mm-hmm.
as was read during our vespers. I mean, it was very moving because there's that conflict between us.
More and more, my values as a Christian are coming in direct conflict with my values as an American. And I've never noticed this in my life before, up until the last 10 years or something. Maybe I just didn't have my eyes open or didn't want to see it. But when Karen came back from Mexico and talked about how people were willing to die, young people, 18, 21, 25-year-olds, ready to die for something that they believed in, I'm all of a sudden beginning to feel that I probably am going to have to die someday in opposition because of my stance as a Christian. And I've never felt this before, that the culture is on an absolute collision course. Mm-hmm. The fact that we need arms says to me, I don't trust God to take care of us. He's not a very pragmatic, realistic kind of God, and I know if we don't have ability to bomb everybody 11 times, there's just no hope for my safety. Well, that's a lot of bull. It really is. It says, where is my security? Where is my strength? If my strength is perfect in weakness, then we ought to be the weakest country in the world. I admire Costa Rica. I didn't know, Bill, that they didn't have a standing army, or the fact that English police don't carry guns. I mean, I don't
America know. Isn't weak at all. You know, we got to be strong. We got to have all these good threats. You know, like the draft is a good sign to Russia that we're strong. We're going to do something. And the arms are a show of our strength. It's just the opposite, like you say, of the Christian values.
But one of the Christian values says to lay down your life for your friend. And I hear a lot of people, not only here, but other places, saying that they don't want to go to war. And I can understand that. I lost a husband in one of the wars. Also, our Christian values say that we're to lay down our life for our friends.
The Russians are our friends also.
No, I'm not talking about that specifically. I'm talking about young men and perhaps women going into the service to defend, if necessary, their own country. And that is what I'm talking about as far as laying down their life for their friends.
But
for
it doesn't say kill another defendants. Person to do it. I mean,
yeah.
It might say throw yourself in front of the automobile.
God's not going to condemn you for it, you know. For, you know, wanting to kill, you know, for something that you believe in. You know, I don't believe that.
I don't think there's ever a reason.
Where would we be at if we had nothing to fight back with, you know?
On the cross?
Years ago. It looked good on this.
Yeah.
But if we were in a strong country in that sort of way, we would be taken over, and who knows where we could be out at, you know? Maybe better off.
Mm.
Yeah. What do we talk about when we say better off or worse off?
Yeah.
It seems like we really get hard into the standard of living at that point. Say we have to live in a different sized house, not drive a car. There are other things too, I think. I mean, I think we do.
You can be tortured every day, though, you know, not just those things.
But what Mary pointed out, I think, is also true. I find this becoming truer and truer also, that what I believe puts me into conflict with my own society. Who's to say that, you know, as an American in 10 years, that we might not be tortured every day?
Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh. I mean, that. We're making some presuppositions that don't hold up. One thing that occurs to me is you always hear about the Russians as being aggressors or being on the offense, and we're always defensive. And it doesn't seem to hold up.
See, that's right too. Do the United States, do we usually are the one, like World War I, World War II, Vietnam and stuff? Did we go there? Did they come here? You know, who started it?
At some point, we were aggressive. I mean, it seems like that would be. At some point, we were. Okay, another assumption we make is that there are no crazy people. You know, everybody would say Hitler's crazy.
Who assumes that, though?
Well, I think we say we can have all this nuclear stuff, and we won't ever have to use it because no one will ever start a war. And that's sort of the assumption behind the defensive posture. And all it takes is somebody who's nuts to be in charge. And that happens. Richard Nixon was pretty close, and he was not that far back, and Hitler. And,
well, at least Nixon got us out of Vietnam if he didn't do anything else. Yeah, he did, but he did get us out of that place when so many people were protesting that we were there.
Peter has had them. Jim, Dan, Bill, Jim, Larry.
I think, you know, John's talking about crazy people and that. But even if there weren't crazy people, you know, the whole thing of the nuclear arms as being a deterrent, that gets back to the old argument is of whether you can do good through something that's inherently evil. Like whether America going to war, which, okay, means people killing other people, prevents a greater evil, for instance. Well, the obvious example is World War II. You know, would Hitler have, you know, wiped out all the Jews in the world or whatever? And, you know, that's just sort of the age old. Is that situation ethics or is that the... No, not it at all. Okay. Well, but the old, is evil justifiable if it prevents a greater evil? It's just a real thorn. Mm-hmm.
Jim?
I think we're trying to adjust, we're trying to move into a new place as American Christians, and it's hard to change. I think we think back a few years to World War I or World War II, and we think about what we did and what the situation was, and we think, well, we did a good thing. It's a good thing we did that. We are in fact proud of what we did. And we celebrate Memorial Day with those remembrances. Hence we go to Iowa and throw wreaths in lakes. Okay, and that's all remembering stuff that's in the past, us, not all of which was good, but a lot of it was good. And we felt good about it all. But now we're moving into a whole new world where we are not defending ourselves against Hitler or Mussolini or whoever. Now we're in a new situation where we are building MX missiles, first strike capability. We are building Trident submarines, first strike capability. And now we have a sneaking suspicion that we are becoming Hitler. Because we never used to build bombs like that before. We have, in our history, I don't know of any bombs that were first strike bombs. MX is. I don't know of any bombs that were first strike like Trident. Now we have them. And so a part of me loves your Iowa parade. And that's why it's like I'm schizophrenic with my faith and patriotism here, because I love what that means and stands for. And I'll rally around the flagpoles. But when I know I'm moving into a new age, I'm upset about it. And I'm confused with my ethics and all. Because I have a sneaking suspicion that I have just become the bad guy. And I'm embarrassed about it, and I'm angry, but I don't want to believe it. But MX and Trident tell me, I mean, I can't figure those two things out, other than to say, I have just become the aggressor.
I don't understand the difference between a first strike and a...
All the rest of our defense systems used to be to say,
they wouldn't work.
They are going to have to press their buttons first. Mm-hmm. And if they press their button, our 27 silos in Bismarck, North Dakota, all the rest of our stuff, all of this was built to respond to their initiative and first strike.
Okay, but only because of a person that responded. It wasn't inherent in the thing.
Yeah, no, they
responded. They had to decide to start the war.
I know, but that was only... I mean, a bomb is a bomb.
Any weapon can be a first strike.
That's right.
No.
Anyway.
Why not?
Is that right?
Any weapon can be a first strike.
I could take a pistol and be the first strike. I don't see any...
Sure, there's nothing inherent in the weapon that makes it... It's the way it's used.
I do have a hard time with saying that Trident or MX is a first strike capability.
Okay, I need to learn that.
I can use it in a defense situation as easy as I can use that in a first strike capability. I can shoot a missile out of North Dakota as easy as I can shoot one out of the
Baltic Sea or somewhere.
Yeah,
I think any weapon has the possibility for a first strike capability anyway.
Let me explain what I've been told about weapons, okay. So I need to learn about this. I've learned that our other weapons were shoot theirs out of the sky type. Mm-hmm. Now we have Trident and MX that can deliver a nuclear warhead within 75, 100, 150 yards of any target in the world. I mean, of the village center. Now that's not defending ourselves against them. That is creating a bomb.
Well, it isn't. If the target is a thing up in the air, it is. What's the difference?
They're designed supposedly so we could wipe out their nuclear systems
first,
so that they couldn't retaliate.
Well, so that's
why you need accuracy. If you're going to strike first, you have to wipe out their reaction systems so they don't get you back.
Now, that's what I've been told about MX and Triton. And maybe that's all wrong.
That's what the Pentagon says. I mean, they have come right out and said that MAD, mutual assured destruction, is no longer our nuclear policy. Mm-hmm. That we now have first strike capability, and that's what they want. They've been very upfront about that. That's Pentagon words, not Sojourner words.
So perhaps it's not so much the weapons as the language that's going with it.
Well, they're being more honest about what policy. They think of using the weapons for.
The way I've had it defined, it is the accuracy that defines a weapon as a first strike weapon, because then it is designed so there cannot be a retaliation.
You can use an accurate weapon to wipe out a military installation rather than a town of, you know, Moscow to all the civilians. I think a weapon is a weapon. I would also say we have that accuracy, that thing simply as a deterrent. I mean, if they have, I can see the armed race building on each side. Well, my missiles are accurate within 75 yards, and they're now mine are within 50. He's got it, so now I'm going to have to do it. That's what I see in it. More of a keeping up or a deterrent to stop them from using it.
As opposed to a fundamental change in American policy.
Well, maybe there's a change, but my what I'm thinking is the change is not in the weapon itself, but in the way it's, in the thinking of how it's going to be used. I mean, I don't, that's where my confusion is. I don't see where... I mean, I hear what you're saying about the accuracy.
There has been an increased talk, as Marilyn said, on the part of the Pentagon, not unlike the talk in the Vietnam War about dealing protective reaction strikes.
What?
Do you remember in bombing on the part of the United States during the Vietnam War, we're anticipating launching aggressive force from the other side. In anticipation of that, we bombed, and we called it preventive reaction strikes. And that kind of talk has been increased of late with respect to developing some of our new weapons. Let me go back to Karen's question about what constitutes defense, because I think in observing Memorial Day, that question of where security resides and what is defense is an important one. And it's worth mentioning that some other countries, since World War II, have taken a different tack than we have. In answer to that question, Japan, for example, has decided not to invest heavily into armament as defense, but rather a conscious policy to deploy, at the direction of the government, diplomats, people from the business community, scientists and technologists, in all directions, so as to work out what they hope will be mutually advantageous policies with, say, countries that have oil. That's very important to Japan because it has no resources of its own, no petroleum resources of its own. So they have, as a national policy decided that security resided in cultivating all kinds of reciprocal relationships with other countries at many kinds of levels, and that that would be Japan's defense. Now it gets them into some trouble. We ask them to extricate themselves from close relationships with Iran on oil deals, and Japan said, we'll have a very difficult time doing that. We'll try a little bit, but we won't go very far. And that's because of this particular defense system. I find that intriguing as an alternative to seeing defense in terms of heavy military establishment. I don't know what your response is to that. That's one comment. The other comment, Karen, in response to the question of what constitutes defense, is the realization of late that many countries are very capable of holding large nations hostage, if you will, in ways that completely leave a huge military establishment impotent. What do you do with an Iran that takes 50 hostages? I mean, what does the defense, what does the Pentagon do in terms of defense, or what kind of security does the military provide for that kind of aggression? So those two matters, a different alternative to defense, and then this whole question of what a large military defense means for a certain kind of real aggression, or in Colombia, with the holding of the ambassadors in the embassy of the Dominican Republic. At what point is that kind of aggression, which is what it is aggression, defended again by the kind of defense that we have chosen? That, for me, those items raise your question as to what a proper observance of Memorial Day means. That is, what truly does constitute security and defense. And those will go on as national concerns in any event. Jim?
In 1945, we started a habit, and we're still in the same habit. And the habit was started in response to Stalin.
Yes.
Japan did started a different habit in 1945. Their habit was, let's be pals with the whole world, like you just
said.
And it worked.
Yeah.
Well, we were in this uncozy World War II relationship with Russia. After the war was over, within 2 weeks, we were just nervous as cats with each other. We still are. 35, 40 years later. Memorial Day maybe is we need a big picnic. See, with all the Russians, and we have Borscht and stuff, and David cooks it or something. I don't know what. There's a Pope or somebody.
Pope could be?
No, he maybe. I don't know. But we're still doing the same thing we did in 1945. We're as nervous now as we were then, and we're still playing the same tune.
Let me read you a paragraph that was written in about 1950 by Herbert Butterfield in a book called Christianity, Democracy, and War. Christianity, Diplomacy, and War. The greatest menace to our civilization today is the conflict between giant organized systems of self-righteousness, each system only too delighted to find that the other is wicked, each only too glad that the sins give it pretext for still deeper hatred and animosity. The effect of the whole situation is barbarizing, since both sides take the wickedness of the other as the pretext for insults, atrocities, and loathing, and each side feels that its own severities are not vicious at all, but simply punitive acts and laudable measures of judgment. There's a kind of easy escalation of giant organized systems of self-righteousness that manifests itself in the kind of action-reaction. And we find it very difficult to understand many third world nations that say a plague on both your houses
read an article that stuck me so much because it talked about the heroes of the last century were the abolitionists. You know, and we look back and say, well, they were the courageous Christians who took a stand against slavery. And we say, well, if we would have been back there, we would have taken our stand. You know, and then if there is still is a world 100 years from now, it will be those Christians today who, you know, I would make this assumption myself. So it would be those Christians who today are making a strong stand on the arms race. And it's almost a beautiful situation. You can be the hero for the next century. The Christian hero, that's what the Lord was going. However, once in a while I stop and think is that we're not, that we are talking about the end of the human race. And that really came home to me when I lived in California, we had a study of stellar nature then. The millions of years that God has taken to evolve the human brain. You know, they shared that instead it's probably the only place in the cosmos where it exists. You know, we don't know that. And what we're talking about is that God's tender caring for a human race and bringing it to where it is now just being wiped out. How do we even begin to talk enough about the seriousness of this? I mean, we're almost relaxed here talking about it. You know, kind of back when, you know, I am too. But once in a while it really hits me. Is the human race precious? Is the human race the apple in the eye of God? The other thing that astounds me is how humanistic we tend to be, in that we somehow we believe that the human is able to handle the nuclear arms race. What is called a delusion, what a denial of our theology of the sinfulness of human beings. I was talking to Gordon today, that was one of the speakers at the youth conference and served the church in Kennewick, which is the nuclear capital of the world in the land. And he was talking about the movement in the field of psychology in order to move towards the perfectly well-adjusted human being that must be developed in order to handle the technology of nuclear energy. You know, and he said, this is, all their talk about the one with the technology, this is a one-time challenge. You know, that you are not going to develop that human being in the laboratory of the science of what you would call behavior psychology. As Christians, I think, would we say this is the ultimate illusion?
What you said about the Soviet Union and the United States, I guess I keep seeing both of our country and that nation as being so much more alike than we want to admit, of your statement. Mm-hmm. That statement can stick right on.
Mm-hmm.
Because we stand in similar positions. We, the aggressor, oppressor in Iran in the past 20 years, and putting a tyrant in power. Now the Soviet Union is doing the same thing in Afghanistan, and appears to be doing that. And we sit back and lambaste them for their communist aggression and for putting a puppet in power was favorable to the Soviet regime. And I guess I just see these two world powers playing the same game around the globe and pointing at each other as the enemy. But it seems like the real struggle, like Karen and the other people in the Third World Forum at 6:30 were saying, that's kind of our delusion. You know, we like to think the best way to the real opposition in the world is, but we have so much in common, our greed and materialism, that's what we're both operating on. They call it communism, we call it capitalism. But we both want the goodies, whereas we both live in fairly secure places right now in terms of how much of the pie the world has to eat, we are eating. We want to keep consuming a more than proportional share, a more than fair share, while the masses of the world don't have enough to exist, most of them. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if we weren't allies with the Soviet Union in not too many years. Because the rage that you can't fight with the military team, such as we've encountered in Iran, militarism breaks down in the face of young people, old people being willing to die for a different vision of what humanity is. And that can take on demonic aspects if you try and use the plant one oppressive system within us. But the kingdom of God and the way of the cross seems to be calling both of those, calling all sex systems of violence what they really are, as being tools of death and inhumanity. And you know, I guess,
and go along with that. Incidentally, there are some people who think we all already are allies and have been for years. The one difference that I see, though, is a real opportunity, and I take the view, while not wanting to say that everyone has the same call that I do, that God has intents and purposes in history. And the opportunity that we have living in this country as Christians is that we have mobility and access to the entire globe. We have the means and wherewithal to go anywhere in the world with the message of Christ right now and today. And that seems like a golden opportunity that we should be pursuing. And that, my way of thinking, it's a trap to get caught up in the window dressing of being looking at my government saying, well, is my government doing this right thing or not? All that certainly should be in our awareness. But taking the positive view that we have a tremendous opportunity now to replace darkness with light and proceed on an active course rather than a reactive course.
But the darkness is concrete form.
You
and
bet.
If you keep it spiritually fluffy.
I'm not talking about fluff. Okay. I could give more details if you'd like. But
when the gospel takes concrete forms wherever you preach it, the peace and the reconciliation, I mean, that has real dire consequences.
It's a life and death matter.
Yeah.
And the thing is, God has a plan, not only for the salvation of his people, everybody, but the redemption and the eradication of evil and the causes of sin in his creation. Mm. And, you know, that maybe that sounds academic as I say it, but there is a particular way that he is going about it, and he intends to go about it. And,
I'm looking at the clock. We have counting at 9:30. I trust the conversation will go on. I don't have a sense that it has come to a close. I would like to finish where we began with a couple of paragraphs from Reinhold Niebuhr's Irony of American History. The first one is on something that we actually haven't talked about, and I just talked about as one more of the things to converse about. And then the second one is a message that I think is particularly appropriate to us as Christians. The first one is Niebuhr's calling to mind a habit in American history. And I was struck, even though this book was written nigh on to 25 years ago, by how that identified habit is still with us. And also a lack of something which has now come up in Iran, shows up in our policy. Okay, Niebuhr writes this. And he is writing at a time when he feels very strong anti-communist, and it goes throughout this whole book, so this is not being soft in his part in those directions. We have had little experience as Americans in the claims and counterclaims of man's social existence, either domestically or internationally. We therefore do not know social existence as an encounter between life and life, or interest with interest, in which moral and non-moral factors are curiously compounded. It is therefore a weakness of our foreign policy, particularly as our business community conceives it, that we move inconsistently from policies which would overcome animosities toward us by the offer of economic assistance to policies which would destroy resistance by the use of pure military might. We respond by offering economic assistance or with military force. That's been our habit in foreign policy, because we do not know the claims and counterclaims of social life. We can understand the neat logic of either economic reciprocity or the show of pure power, but we are mystified by the endless complexities of human motives and the varied compounds of ethnic loyalties, cultural traditions, social hopes, envies, and fears that enter into the policies of nations and which lie at the foundations of their political cohesion. That's a commentary on Iran, if ever there was one. We're mystified. We can understand economic reciprocity or the show of pure force, but we are mystified by the endless complexities of human motives and the varied compounds of ethnic loyalties, cultural traditions, social hopes, and envies and fears that enter into the traditions of nations and which lie at the foundation of their political cohesion. Now, finally, a word of to hang in there, everybody. There are no simple congruities in life or history. The cult of happiness erroneously assumes them. It is possible to soften the incongruities of life endlessly by the scientific conquest of nature's caprices and the social and political triumph of historic injustice. But all such strategies cannot finally overcome the fragmentary character of human existence. The final wisdom of life requires not the annulment of incongruity, but the achievement of serenity within it and above it. Nothing that is worth doing can be achieved in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing which is true or beautiful or good makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. Therefore, we are saved by love. No virtuous act is quite as virtuous from the standpoint of our friend or foe as it is from our standpoint. Therefore, we must be saved by the final form of love, which is forgiveness.